The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Gene Case, president of the Case Foundation and author of Be Fearless, Five Principles for a Life of Breakthroughs and Purpose, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving on AM 970 The Answer, WNYM in New York City.
The influence that leaders from the tech sector have had on the world of philanthropy over the past two decades has been profound. The creation of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in the year 2000 was certainly a pivotal moment in that regard. But several years before that, in 1997 to be precise, this influence started to be realized when Steve and Gene Case of AOL, America Online, founded the Case Foundation. And it's a great pleasure to have with us this evening Gene Case, the CEO of the foundation and the author of a fabulous new book, Be Fearless, Five Principles for a Life of Breakthroughs and Purpose. Good evening, Gene, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, good evening, Denver. I've really been looking forward to this time with you.
Likewise. You and your husband were digital pioneers, and I can recall how mission-centric AOL was in those early days. Share with us with the journey from there to starting the Case Foundation some 21 years ago.
Sure. Well, for those who are maybe not as familiar because they're too young with the mission of AOL, and back in those days, we were really about building the Internet revolution. But it was about democratizing access to ideas and information and communication and really empowering people. We found success at one time. AOL carried 50% of the nation's Internet traffic.
Wow.
So we saw firsthand the power to use resources to empower others. And I think we always knew that if resources came our way, we would want to share them with the world and continue to use them to empower others.
Mm-hmm. And I find the foundation expresses its theory of change with wonderful clarity. And let's touch on a few of those elements if we can. One of them would be inclusive entrepreneurship, and the data around that is quite startling. So, taking venture capital as an example, Gene, how is that distributed across the United States?
Well, it's really quite alarming to see the consolidation of venture capital today, and it's unprecedented in our nation. I'll give you some data to get started. Last year, 90% of venture capital went to firms founded by men, leaving only 10% available to women. But the capital itself was only 2% that went to women. It was 10% of the deals, but 2% of the capital. Only 1% flowed to African-American founders. And perhaps most alarming, 78% of the capital went to just three places in the nation, California, New York, and Massachusetts.
47 states fighting over the other 22%.
Absolutely. So in some cases, a state might get all year what a Silicon Valley firm could get in a week.
Well, let's take that last one then. You have always believed that the people closest to the problem are the one closest to the solution. So if venture capital is targeted towards the middle of America, as opposed to the two coasts that you just mentioned, what pockets of innovation do you see springing up?
Oh, sure. Well, let's just think about ag tech, for instance. Food as another example. You know, think about some of the needs that we have in this planet to look at our land and to look at our food and to look at our agriculture. Where is that expertise in the nation? It is in our nation's heartland. So that's one example of a sector that we see so much promise in terms of new innovations, but we need to make sure that we bring mentors and capital and what we call that jet fuel to allow some of these new innovations to grow.
Yeah, and another example I think you cited was New Orleans and education, correct?
Absolutely. A lot of people don't know it, but after Hurricane Katrina, there was a flood of about 1,000 Teach for America young people who went down there in the schools. And what you talked about, Denver, is spot on. They saw problems and they came up with solutions, many of them in the form of new companies in what we call ed tech or education technology. So it's become a real hub. Nashville's become a real hub for healthcare. So in certain pockets, and if we look at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We tend to think of it as an old steel town, but today it has really become a hub for both robotics and AI. A lot of the driverless car technology that Uber and Ford and others are taking forward, they're doing so right there in Pittsburgh.
Carnegie Mellon, that's
absolutely.
Right. So Another thing that you've been a pioneer in has been impact investing. In fact, you may have started impact investing before anybody had coined the term impact investing.
Well, not exactly. What I
we're
would say
close.
Is we were doing impact investing before we knew there was a term for it. Let's put it that way.
There you go.
It was actually a team that came together and coined the phrase. But yes, we've been deeply engaged in impact investing for a long time. And there, of course, we're talking about financial investments that provide both a financial return but also a social return. And we're excited by the growing momentum in the space.
Mm-hmm. Where do you see us along that journey right now in terms of the arc of impact investing?
Yeah, well, I feel really good about it. I mean, you know, we're at a point where hundreds of billions of dollars are going into it. It doubled over the last year. I just came back from Paris with a group of high net worth individuals who were coming together to look at impact investing opportunities. And really everywhere I go, last summer I was in Seoul, Korea with a group of Asian investors. But around the world and here in America, we're seeing tremendous traction and momentum in the movement.
Mm-hmm. Another area of focus for the foundation has been around civic engagement. In fact, I remember one of your campaigns, Get in the Arena.
Exactly.
Are we beginning to see that in a more pronounced way now?
You know, I think we are. And I think we're going to talk a little bit about this when we talk about the book. But I do think people look around at their world today and they feel a passionate need to make a difference. I think this next generation, which we've followed through research for the last decade, touched over 100,000 of them in terms of getting their views and their insights around social good. Look, like all young generations, they're idealistic.
Mm-hmm.
What's different about this generation is they're turning their idealism really into action. And by the way, voting. We were very, very encouraged to see the degree of voting that took place among the next generation in these recent midterms we had.
One last thing about the foundation itself. From all the initiatives that you've created, developed, been part of, is there anyone that you're particularly excited or proud or fond of?
So, Denver, they're all like my children. What I will say, though, is we try to capture what we do by saying we invest in people and ideas that can change the world. And we've been so privileged to find and fund and spotlight great people all over the world doing extraordinary things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I so much enjoyed reading your book. Let's turn our attention to that, where you lay out the five principles of what it takes to be fearless. And, you know, one of the things I loved about the book is that I actually remember the five principles. And so often when I read books, I'm always going back to find out what the two or the six or the eight principles are. These things are so natural.
Great.
That they stick with your mind. And I'm going to walk through each one of them and have you talk about them, if you would, starting with big bets, make big bets, and make history. Now, sounds like incrementalism isn't going to take us to where we need to go. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, we should point out that those principles were developed as part of work we did several years back at the Case Foundation, using research and led by some social scientists to look around and look back and say, hey, lots of people chase big ideas and transformational things. Why do some break out and others don't?
Mm-hmm.
And what we found, of course, were these five principles that I think we're going to walk through. It does start with making a big bet, rejecting incremental change and really trying to embrace a very big idea. It is constant no matter where you look, no matter where in the world, no matter what sector you're looking at, that it starts with a big idea, a truly big bet.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of those big bets was around malaria. And you cite that in the book. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, malaria is a great story. You know, there's a great leader here in New York, Ray Chambers.
Fantastic guy.
Yeah, fantastic guy who really got deeply engaged in malaria. He had this unbelievably successful career as an investor and really was storied. MBA students learn about his success on that front. But then kind of took a right turn in life and
mm-hmm.
said, now I really want to spend the rest of my time giving away what I've earned. And so he jumped into malaria really knowing nothing about it. He was on a trip to Africa and he observed some children in a hospital and he said, oh, they're all sleeping. And someone said, no, they're in malaria coma. I think that was a day that changed the rest of his life because he committed to bringing together a terrific collaboration to focus on malaria. And the story in a nutshell, Denver, I think, is that there were lots of people out there doing different things for malaria. And if you might have gone to someone making a bed net and say, what are you doing? They would have said, well, I'm making a bed net for malaria. after Ray pulled this collaboration together around a big idea, which is eradicate malaria off the planet, you go to those people today and they say, you say, what are you doing? And they say, I'm helping to eradicate malaria from the planet.
Yeah.
So it's a great model. And of course, you know, the rollback of malaria across the areas that he has focused on has just been extraordinary. In some countries, as much as an 80% reduction.
Yeah, it's amazing how big bets just energize people.
No question.
Who are kind of just walking through their paces, but then all of a sudden they get excited and they become superhuman in some ways.
Right. Well, if you think about it, there's almost a physical analogy to it that I think about, which is we're marching forward, but wait, now suddenly we're linked arms. We're marching together toward a common vision and a really big idea. And I think that does galvanize and coalesce people in a powerful way.
Yeah, one of my favorite quotes around this is somebody said that if you are having trouble rolling a small rock up a hill, the thing to do is go find a bigger rock. Because the way you think changes and the energy you have to push changes as well.
Very interesting.
The second principle is be bold, take risks. And I'm intrigued how that word risk is almost never used in the sector. So I'm so glad, Gene, that you have brought up the R word. How do you need to look at this if you're going to be a fearless leader?
You know, it's very funny because I spend time across all sectors. And while we may be quick to understand that maybe the nonprofit or philanthropy sector is a little less comfortable with risk, it turns out across sectors, people are uncomfortable with risk. And so one of the things that I point out in the book is, what if we look at risk-taking as R&D? We understand that to do transformational things in science and in medicine and in technology, we have to deploy an R&D strategy and usually a budget along with it as well of time or money. And so really, if we think about risk along the lines of research and development in our own lives, in our own organization, and try new things, it becomes a little less scary. That risk word does scare people. But the bottom line is, you can't do new things. You can't break through with innovations without taking significant risk.
And I love that concept of R&D, because when you change the language, it just has a completely different connotation.
It really does.
To what you're doing.
It really does.
And you feel good about, I'm doing some R&D.
Yeah.
I'm not risking donors' money.
And, you know, one of the quotes I put in the book was Steve Jobs, because, you know, he said he's heard from people who say they don't have R&D budgets, so how are they supposed to compete in this world? And he points out that a lot of it comes down to a passionate team and really a point of view about, we're going to try some things and we're going to keep going even if we fail along the way.
The third principle is to make failure matter. And while failure is celebrated in Silicon Valley, or if it's not celebrated, at least it's accepted as a necessary part of the process, it's not so much the case in the social sector, where the problems are even more daunting. What do you think the reason for that is?
You know, I've thought a lot about this, and we think more broadly about the social sector, which could be comprised of, let's say, the government or the public sector, philanthropy, and nonprofits. And in all those three cases, the money that they're deploying often comes from someone else, right? In the case of the government, it's taxpayer money. In the case of philanthropy, sometimes you're shepherding someone's money who lived 100 years ago. In nonprofits, of course, you want to keep your donors pleased. So I think, without intention, what that has led to is a reluctance to talk about what isn't working or where there was failure. What I love is, I think there is a new breed of philanthropists and donors who encourage their organizations and even their governments to say, try some crazy things and let's see where we can go. You know, I think that it was a message we first devised thinking that it was really aimed at the social sector, because we had come out of technology where we understood the importance of taking risks to break through. But it turns out, as I said earlier, really all sectors need this message. Big companies, as they get more comfortable and established, it's too easy for them not to want to take a risk, to put all of that at risk. So surprisingly to us, the message of be fearless more broadly has resonated across sectors.
And I think also sometimes is that we tend to underestimate donors. Organizations are afraid how donors are going to react if they fail. But they're actually a little bit more intelligent than that. They understand if we're going to make some great change. So this is almost an assumption, which is really not always true.
Right. And it goes back a little bit to that big bet, or let's say big idea, because I think if you bring the donor in and you say, we're going to try something, but we're trying it towards achieving something really great, that we don't see how we can get there without taking some risks, will you back us? I think that kind of kumbaya moment between the donor and the one receiving the funds is important and can provide air cover then when failure does happen.
Well, when you talk about make failure matter, you actually have experienced that firsthand. With a water initiative you did in sub-Saharan Africa. Tell us that story. It's a great story.
Sure. Well, first of all, Denver, I need to make clear that isn't my only failure story, as you might imagine, but that's certainly
one
I highlighted in the book, and it's very public. Yeah, so we introduced a very large initiative called Play Pumps, and it was this really innovative technology that used a children's merry-go-round, kind of like a windmill on the ground, if you think about it, to pump clean water.
Mm-hmm.
We put a big collaboration together. We launched it at the Clinton Global Initiative with President Clinton to my right and First Lady Laura Bush to my left.
Oh boy.
So it was very high profile. We brought a number of partners in. And as we began to deploy across 10 sub-Saharan African countries, we started to get some feedback from the field that there were some issues here, some issues over there. We did what any organization or initiative would do. And, you know, we spent about a year or two trying to course correct. And finally, it became clear it wasn't working and we had a choice to make. And again, I talk about this in the book. And of course, we were tempted to say, can't we just sweep that thing under the rug and not talk about it?
Oh, yeah.
But we knew what we had to do. And so in the end, we did decide to come clean. I wrote a very public blog called The Painful Acknowledgement of Coming Up Short. And frankly, that was probably where our Be Fearless work was born, even though we didn't know it at the time. It was, because what I saw immediately was my peers across all sectors saying, thank you for acknowledging failure. It doesn't happen enough. And of course, we didn't just shut it down. We pivoted and found a better way forward. But I think it was particularly the public acknowledgement that was rare. And then we started these things called Fail Fests,
mm-hmm.
where we would get groups together and we would share stories of failure, not to celebrate them at all, but to really use them as teachable moments. And, you know, some of the failures that stories that others have boldly shared with me have helped me be better as I take on other things because I can learn from them.
I can just picture you trying to hit send after you wrote that blog.
Boy.
I mean, I can see the hand shaking.
No question.
Like, pull the push down.
Yeah, really one of the hardest send buttons I've ever had.
for sure. The fourth principle is reach beyond your bubble. So I guess being firmly planted in your comfort zone is no way to be fearless. Talk to that.
That's exactly right. Another way that we describe that is the importance of building unlikely collaborations and partnerships. You know, it's surprising, but when you look back at things that have broken through, it actually is because people were able to stop and say, I don't have everything it takes to take this big idea forward. I need people unlike me with complementary skills, perspectives, and backgrounds. That's a really important part of the secret sauce of transformation. So, yes, it's a very important principle, and we see this play out in big ways.
Yeah. In fact, at the Case Foundation, you've really made cross-sector collaboration something that everybody has to do.
We do. So most of our major initiatives, if not all, have had a nonprofit partner, a public sector partner, and a corporate or business partner as well. And it's specifically because each one brings a different expertise or capability that we don't necessarily have and then helps us be able to aim much bigger and broader in our efforts.
One of the examples in the book you cite is the Four Freedoms Fund. Speak to that.
Well, you know, it's an example of a lot of different things that we've done through time. I think when we look back at the things that have been most effective, it's because we can actually pinpoint how different it was than something that we were familiar with or an expertise that we had.
Mm-hmm. And my favorite of your five principles is the final one, and that is let urgency conquer fear. In fact, you quote Martin Luther King in the book talking about the fierce urgency of now. Talk a little bit about
that. Boy, that's right. And, you know, I really think about that in this day. I think many people are walking around feeling the fierce urgency of now.
Mm.
I think they see division. I think they see, in many cases, fear gripping communities. And, you know, this sense of urgency that we feel can sometimes get us out of our comfort zones enough because it's pushing us. It's an urgency we feel to maybe do something that in normal course and speed, we wouldn't be able to dig deep and really go take that risk.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the reasons I think I like this one so much, this principle, is that with the other four, I'm thinking about them. But when I have urgency, my body gets involved.
That's your action point.
Absolutely. And when my body gets involved and I'm not thinking too much, things just happen. Whereas there's a lot that can go on upstairs in your head, which will allow me to rationalize it or procrastinate it. But urgency, when your body is engaged, things begin to happen.
Yeah, and, you know, we haven't talked about it, but although we do talk about the principles in the book, and they're the basis of the book, as you know, Denver, they really are brought out through storytelling, great stories of people who have lived these principles in a meaningful way. And in urgency, we're used to, for instance, on a battlefield or in a natural disaster, people do extraordinary things, and
right,
that is urgency really pushing them forward. But I also try to bring some examples forward of ordinary people who've done extraordinary things because they felt that deep sense of urgency in the moment.
Well, give us an example of one of those.
Sure. Well, Corrie Ten Boom is an unlikely hero, I think, in many respects. A woman who, in her 50s, she was single and living with her father above a watchmaking shop in Holland when she witnessed a terrible act. It was the late 30s when the Nazis were moving across Europe, and she witnessed a Jewish neighbor being led out of his house and held at gunpoint. She was so horrified, she ran across the street and grabbed him. The soldiers had gone into the house to ransack it. She grabbed him and brought him into the shop. And that began for her a fearless life as a soldier in the resistance army against the Nazis. She ended up saving hundreds of Jews. She went to a concentration camp herself and suffered for her actions. And when she was finally released, she went right back to that same fearless resistance work that she had done before. But I'm quite certain if that urgent moment hadn't hit her, it might have been different for her to find the boldness to do some extraordinary things.
You're absolutely right. And you also have admired the fearlessness of Betty Ford. Why
yes.
so?
Well, you know, I think Betty Ford's fearlessness isn't acknowledged enough.
I agree with you.
A couple of ways. First of all, as many people might know, she developed breast cancer when she was First Lady. And I'm a breast cancer survivor.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we don't remember it, but it wasn't talked about. Remember, it has the word breast in it. My goodness. We don't talk about that.
We'll have to blip this.
But she was very transparent about what she had gone through. And really, I think many people give her credit for the way, you know, routine screens and scans are adopted today and more women go for them because it was put on the table as a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Women in many cases didn't know what to do. The second reason is because of her own battle with addictions. You know, she did have addictions and substance abuse, both alcohol and drugs. And, you know, her family boldly confronted her with it. And she boldly took action. And then, of course, out of that was born the Betty Ford Center, which is perhaps one of the best-known rehabilitation centers in the nation. And over 100,000 people have received care through the Betty Ford Center since that time. But when you think about those two things, right, something involving that word breast, but also really sort of what can be otherwise shame and hiding of an addiction problem, because of her transparency, she's been able to affect the lives of many, many people.
That's a great point. Two taboo issues that she really shined a bright light on.
Exactly.
Momentum is carried forward. And speaking of family, there's been an issue close to your family, and that has to do with Accelerate Brain Cancer Cure. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, that's an organization we co-founded as a family with my late brother and my sister-in-law.
Mm-hmm.
He developed brain cancer, a glioblastoma, at the age of 41. And it was very clear that, you know, there was not very much survivability of that cancer at the time. So as lay people, we began to ask a bunch of questions. He was an amazing leader himself. And so we decided, well, maybe there's an opportunity to try to accelerate therapies for that cancer. At the time, the therapies being used had been used for 20 years. There was no innovation. So we brought a large collaborative together, and I'm really grateful to say that survivability has really extended and many new therapies have been brought into the field in the last 20 years or so.
Well, Be Fearless is certainly not just a book. It's a movement and something that you have championed for such a long time now. It's probably almost part of you.
Definitely.
But now that the book is here, what are some of the things you're going to do to try to activate this movement so people, in fact, do become fearless?
Well, our hope is that in laying out the principles, but honestly, in using these inspirational stories of what I really do believe people will see as ordinary people, maybe just like themselves, who dug deep, applied the principles, and ended up doing extraordinary things. So we hope it's a clarion call. We think it is a good antidote to the fear and sort of some of the discouragement that people feel out there, and hopefully just an inspiration for people to take whatever their big idea or solution that they see they can be part of to take that forward.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. When we look at some of these luminaries, we say to ourselves, well, I'm not like that. But when you see these everyday people, it's much easier to see ourselves in that person.
That's right.
And therefore say, well, maybe me too. And it gives you the courage and the inspiration to move ahead.
Right. And I will say, Denver, you know, part of the reason I just wove some vignettes from my own life into the book is because I think anyone who looked at me early in life would never predict that I would be able to go have the career I did in technology or move on to philanthropy and do some of the things I've had the opportunity to do. So I feel it myself. I mean, anyone can look at himself or herself and say, that's not me. But the real message of the book is that is you, and come join us.
Yeah, well, tell us a little bit more about that, because you grew up in some pretty challenging circumstances. Tell us about that and how it's really informed your life.
Sure. Well, I was the youngest child of a single mom. We had four kids in our family, and I was the youngest. So, yeah, we did face some challenges. Perhaps, you know, in some ways, I think it's a very American story. As a recipient of philanthropy myself, I was on a full scholarship at a private school. You know, I was then able to come around and use my own resources to help those who follow behind me. So it's a rare situation in life, I think, where you move from being a recipient of the generosity of others to being in a position in life where then you can share yours with others as well.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn back to the Case Foundation for a moment and tell us a little bit about the corporate culture. What is unique and distinctive about it, and why is it such a special place in which to work?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe this will help define it a little bit. So when we review where we are with things as part of our annual planning, for instance, we do business plans, but we use this green, yellow, red light theory. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind it is, okay, we're looking at, did we bring to it what we needed to? Did the partner bring to it what they needed to do? And if it's green, it's like, oh yeah, we're off to the races. If it's yellow, it's like, whoa, we better watch that one. And red usually means it's failing. And one year when we did the review, I noticed there were no reds. And so we had a heart-to-heart as a team and said, look, if we really are trying to push the envelope, if we really are trying to bring innovation, we have to have some reds because nobody bats 1,000. And so now we try to make sure that there's always a few things in our portfolio where we're never really sure how they're going to turn out, but we're aiming for something big. And I think in many ways that's a good definition of the culture that we have. And I've been so fortunate. I have this extraordinary team of people who inspire me every day. And I think they're very entrepreneurial in their approach. And we have a lot of fun in the process as well.
That sounds good. Yeah, you're right. If you don't have enough reds or any reds, it means you're not taking enough chances.
That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. You and your husband became part of the Giving Pledge, I think it was back in 2011. And it's grown into this community of sorts where you all learn from each other. Share with us what it's like to have been part of this distinguished group.
Sure. Well, I must say our commitment to give away the majority of our resources, that commitment was made long before there was a Giving Pledge. It was a little uncomfortable for us to think about being so public with the Giving Pledge when we joined. But ultimately, I think what put us over the line to yes was this really unique opportunity to learn with and from others. So it is really a network of people who are doing exactly what we're trying to do, which is figure out the smartest ways to use your resources to empower others. And it's been a powerful teaching tool for us.
Let me close with this, Jean. What has the impact of philanthropy been on your own life? How has it changed you, and how has it made you the person that you have become?
Well, I would say anything that I am or any opportunities I've had, I have someone else to thank for that. Their time, their resources, their mentoring, their care. Anyone can be a philanthropist. Anyone can make a difference in this world. The reason I wrote the book is to make that crystal clear. There are stories that, as I said earlier, I think anyone will see some of himself or herself in. And, you know, that's what philanthropy has done for me. I wake up every day grateful for the opportunity to work on some really daunting challenges across the world. But it's also some of the most fun I've ever had in my life. So I encourage everyone to jump in.
Yeah, well, you do make it fun. I do know that. And your North Star has always been empowering others, and that's what this book is going to do. So.
Thank you, Denver.
Well, Jean Case, the CEO of the Case Foundation and the author of Be Fearless, Five Principles for a Life of Breakthroughs and Purpose. I want to thank you so much for being on the show this evening. If people want to get a peek of some of what's included in that book, you share a lot of that online. Where can people go to find it?
ReadBeFearless.com. It's a great place to see a summary of the book, to see what others are saying about it, and to order the book.
Well, this is the perfect book to read if you really want to get 2019 off on the right foot. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show, Jean.
Thank you so much, Denver. Pleasure to be with you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at Facebook.com/Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.